bringing on out the best in me.
I don't care what they say, it's between me and you. You know what I'm saying?
Crazy, you got me going crazy. You make it so easy. How will I let you take control?
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Be Better podcast. We are once again being joined here on the phone with some friends. They're not up here in the Playhouse, up here in the Final K World Headquarters. We are being joined today by Brian D'Amico, Events Director from USA Triathlon, and Matt Rieger, National Events Manager, also from USA Triathlon, calling us all the way from beautiful Colorado Springs, Colorado. Brian, Matt, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Well, so you guys are, we're kind of doing a new thing again, because we've done some new stuff with this phone call interviews, and so you're the first ones we're doing kind of on a speakerphone, so that you guys are going to set the bar as to what other people have to live up to or work past going forward.
I like it. We can do that. We'll project very well.
The bar will be hit very high.
Mm-hmm. Very high. Well, you guys do pretty good work together. I must say, I have to give it up to you. I was just looking to get your exact titles on the new USAT website, and I was pleasantly surprised to see some handsome photos of you two guys. Matt, the lumberjack shirt is totally in effect for you.
You like that one? I recently got a lumberjack shirt from REI that had a lumberjack riding a mountain bike on top of a mountain. I thought that shirt probably summed up my life experiences probably to a T.
Well, in reading your profile here, it says favorite activity, anything outdoors, including hiking, mountain biking, hunting, and camping. So I think that totally fits inside your wheelhouse.
There we go.
Now Brian, on the other hand, looks like a grown up. He's got the white collar, button down. I noticed no ties seems to be the office theme in these photos as well. Another very good photo. This is about the cleanest I've seen you guys ever before.
Thank you. Yeah, I was debating to go back and forth whether I wear a tie or not, but Cody wore the full suit and suit jacket that we made up for Lost Ground that we didn't provide on our end.
Well, Cody does kind of class up the office a little more than you guys sometimes, but we'll touch on that later. Maybe off air. So you guys have been with USAT for a while. Brian, first, tell us how you came to USAT and kind of a little bit of your background.
Yeah, so I started with USAT 6 years ago as the youth event and program manager. So I was in that role for 2 years, and then I transitioned to national events manager, and then senior manager, and then director of events, which is where I am now. So prior to that, I graduated from Ohio State University, where I did my undergrad in sport management. It was actually called Sport and Leisure Studies, which I know sounds very leisurely, but they have since changed it and all that. So I graduated from there, and then went to for grad school, which is in Cincinnati for sport administration. After that, I ventured down to Florida, where I worked for United Soccer Leagues, which is now USL, and they're now Division II right under the MLS in the U.S. soccer pyramid. So I worked there, moving up to senior director of youth league and youth league development for about 3 years prior to coming out here in 2012. So it's kind of on a whim I came out here, went through pretty much the standard process, didn't know anyone out here except my wife's family. So ultimately got the position and have kind of moved up and progressed from there.
And you have moved up very well. Being events director, are you technically the lead race director when it comes to national events? Is that pretty much your role?
Yeah, for the most part, I've relinquished my duties for Duathlon Nationals to Matt, so he kind of spearheads that. But pretty much for all the other events, serving as race director and all those good things that come with race directing in terms of permitting, kind of being the main point of contact, leading the countless all-city calls just to make sure everyone is on the same page. And then in addition to that, kind of working through the bid processes with various cities, CDBs, LOCs, which are local organizing committees, and just kind of making sure everybody's on the same page with their expectations with us, our expectations of them. Because believe it or not, it is, you know, if you have an existing event in the city for an extended period of time, there's that good rapport that goes on. You know, the city, police, traffic control, everybody kind of is dialed in as to what happens. With our events, with our own national championships, which is our big four, we rotate to the cities generally every 2 years. So it's really starting over. We don't like to take courses that have already been established if that city already has an existing multi-sport event. So it's kind of reinventing the wheel. And a lot of that is education. A lot of that is, you know, looking at who it affects, how it affects them, how do we cater to them, how do we get them out of neighborhoods, not to mention the cost that generally the LLC assists us with.
Yeah, and that's and from what I've seen, that model of how you approach that has been has kind of changed in your, I would say, as you've come in. Some of your predecessors have kind of approached that in a different manner. And when I say different manner, I mean more of a, you know, one guy runs the roost, one man show, lone gunslinger, one man wolf pack. I got about six or seven more of these in my pocket if I need to pull out any more. But you have somebody that within Matt that is essentially your wingman or almost your equal. That in the effect that something does happen, you guys can step right in and take each other's place almost seamlessly. Is that how you see this? And was that kind of planned?
Yeah, so that's very accurate. So what we've tried to do is, you know, with everyone in our newly formed events department, which is actually the national events team and event services team into one. But what we've tried to do with Matt and then also Kelsey and Cody that are on the event side of things is to make sure that if I were to be hit by a bus, I know very extreme, but if I were to be hit by a bus, that Matt, Kelsey, and Cody could step in and run the event. So we're pretty candid and upfront with each other, and everybody's looped in. So with these all-city calls and kind of working through the permitting process and things like that, everybody is totally looped in. So I would say Matt is kind of the second in charge within the department on in terms of national event side. But at any time, Cody and Kelsey can certainly step right in. So that's very accurate.
Yeah, and that model, we'll touch on that in a little bit. That model was definitely put into a test here this last year. But before we get into that story, Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing well. You're still with us. I didn't mean to drop you off the conversation here. But Matt, how did you come to triathlon? What's kind of your backstory, and how did you end up landing in events?
Yeah, so I've been here for almost exactly 4 years now. I actually had my 4-year anniversary on March, I believe it was March 16th, last Friday. So celebrated that coincidentally with St. Patrick's Day. So that was a nice celebration.
Congratulations.
I started in our national events department as national events coordinator. And then a year in, transitioned into the national events manager role and really started out working closely on a lot of our equipment, our vendor solicitation process, venue setup, the production crew, and really got to know our big 53-foot semi-trailer that some of the athletes and race staff probably get used to seeing out at events. So really made that my baby and kind of all things that spurred out from that. And then slowly transitioned to the national events manager role, and then Kelsey Dolphin transitioned into the national events coordinator role. And started to bolster and kind of craft my skills in race management, and slowly transitioned into the dynamic that you noted before, kind of being Brian's right-hand man, serving as race director for Duathlon Nationals, working a lot on traffic control, a lot of our medical assets, on water safety personnel and things like that, and also heading up a lot of our permitting process with Brian as well. So before that, so I'm originally from Minnesota, so there's yeah. No, the final table supporters very, very well. So I went to Minnesota State down in Mankato for both my undergrad and graduate degree. Held a combination of internships with the athletic department there, and then coincidentally, the Vikings had held training camp down there for, I think it's now the past 4 years that will now be ending. So got to know them and their staff a little bit. And once graduated with my master's degree, went on to do some full-time internships with the Vikings and get some experience with them. And then coincidentally, a lot of former interns that they had also interned with the United States Olympic Committee. And with my love for the mountains and wanting to get involved with the Olympic movement somehow, I was fortunate enough to network with a couple staff members here. And the National Events job opening opened up and interviewed, and lo and behold, here we are. So I have to say, I never thought I'd be working in the triathlon world, endurance sport world, when I first started out. But it's been quite the ride. It's not every sporting event where you get to hone your logistical skill set quite like a triathlon. Obviously, with a basketball game or a football game, everything is centralized. Everything is stationary. You only have one field of play to worry about, and there's not people or cars crossing that field of play. We've been fortunate enough to hone our logistical skills having, three different courses to worry about over an 8-hour time span.
It is kind of like planning three simultaneous weddings, I would say. That's what I've used.
When you say it like that, it doesn't make it sound fun.
And we've had our fair share of working around weddings at venues for our events as well. So that's always fun.
Oh, wow. That'd be too much. Yeah, I've always tried to say that it's a lot more than just what other people think it might be. It's more than just coordinating a 5K. But Matt, I didn't know you were from Minnesota. That's something I didn't know about you from before. That's actually makes you even higher ranked in my book.
I like it. I like working my way up. Yeah, from Jordan, Minnesota.
Wow. I was just down there mountain biking the other day. Just along in the river bottom. So that's when you come home, we'll have to go do some mountain biking down there.
I like it. I'm 100% in. I've got a nice shop right by our house that I've rented some bikes from before. So I'm 100% in.
Well, let me know and I'll take care of you. So Matt, I have to ask, you make no mention of it here in your bio, but where did you hone your skills for forklifting?
I do always say, and maybe I shouldn't go on the record with this, but I'm the best uncertified forklift driver that you will ever find. I have to credit when I was growing up. Jordan was a big farming community. It's not quite as big a farming community as it was at the time, but just did a lot of machinery, driving, lots of baling hay and things like that, working on the farm, so getting accustomed to driving some of those bigger style machines, whether that was a tractor, bobcat, things like that. And then over the summers, during college, when I wasn't interning either with the athletic department, or anything like that, I landscaped for 5 summers. So, got fairly accustomed to the forklifts around the shop, bobcats on site and things like that. So, and it didn't come without trial by error. Unfortunately, one time tipped a bobcat over. So that was the lone incident. Luckily, no one was around. No one really wasn't by any structures. But
I am signing him up for forklift.
That is on the record.
I'm surprised you guys can get sanctioning with you not being a legal forklift driver. I mean, I even had to, when I worked at Menards back in high school, I had to like go through like a 8-hour class to drive the forklifts just around the yard there. And you've kind of winged it. That's awesome. I don't know if I'm impressed or if I'm angry.
I think any official staff member has seen my skills in real time that they just kind of assume like, oh, he's got to be certified. We don't even have to question it.
Mad skills. Cause you can flip a quarter with that thing, can't you?
I don't know if I've quite not gotten that good. Maybe by the time event season gets done with my my wrist is I'm good at the controls, I can get that down. But that might take a little more practice.
Well, it's always fun because you're pretty much the only one who gets to drive it. So maybe someday you'll let us all drive the Zamboni and we can share in that kind of thrill.
I like the sound of that.
All right, good time. So I kind of hinted at it earlier before, but so you guys with your two person approach or with the new team approach that we have for national events, and I say we because I feel like I'm kind of part of the family and that I get to be on the bike course with you guys and working for you. I have to say that it really kind of got put to the test in Sarasota last year, and I. I think that if you look at it from a holistic standpoint or step back, it was worth every penny that, you know, maybe might be extra in our budget to have, you know, to say have more people in this in this department or division, to be able to have something happen where, like, a little bit of backstory, Brian, you got sick and you were not able to direct that day. And Matt, you stepped in and the team stepped in and were able to allow Brian to leave the venue. And really the race was pretty, you know, unaffected because of the professionalism and the training and the execution and the planning that the staff had. And did you kind of feel like that was a kind of, I don't know, justification and, you know, this is exactly why we're doing what we're doing? Did you get a chance to think about that afterwards?
Yeah, from what I can remember, yes. but yeah, and I think that's the big thing. So, it was an international event, not to mention our Draft Legal Triathlon World Qualifier. So it had two different components and two different groups working together to achieve kind of that one common goal. I know that sounds rah-rah, but that's kind of what it was all about. And, you know, obviously in working through things, there's going to be challenges, but, you know, for the sake of the event or for the athletes, those challenges had to be put aside, and this was a big challenge. But like you said, I don't know, aside from the staff that was working the event, whether it be from USAT staff, Nathan Benderson Park staff in Sarasota, or the ISU staff, other than them knowing kind of what had happened, I don't think anyone else had any idea, which is how we want it, because everything that happens, you know, behind the scenes, we don't want it to affect either we'll call it the run of show of the event or the athlete's experience. So that's kind of, as we drew it up, where everyone is amply armed with all the information that they need. So that's how I see it from my perspective, but I'll let Matt, he may have a very different perspective, kind of being thrown into the fire, but I'll let him speak on that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's definitely a testament to kind of, as you noted, the overall team structure and teamwork, you know, that we as a core internal USA Triathlon staff, and then obviously extending out to everyone involved with the event, you know, such as yourself and course coordinators and personnel within the venue, and how well that was directed, obviously, by Brian, but then how well they function as a team together. I think we pride ourselves a lot on really hammering that point home in all the meetings that we have, all the contingency plans that we develop, and really empowering the course coordinators and other personnel, you know, that may not necessarily be in a lead position necessarily, but still empowering them to say, hey, this is your area, this is your transition, you know, you are responsible safety-wise, athlete-wise, you know, to make decisions here. And I think that dynamic really, you know, in a situation such as that where there was kind of a shift in the overall lead, can still go to making that event successful. And it was an awesome showcase too of how well contingency plans can come into play. You know, sometimes I feel that those get overlooked a little bit. You know, when you're planning an event, obviously it takes so much effort and so much bandwidth just to go into planning, you know, the frontline plans of an event. But really showcase how important it is, how imperative it is to have those contingency plans, you know, for every possible avenue for something that can go wrong, because it's going to go in the end to ensuring that event is still success.
Yeah, from an outside standpoint, and from a contributing standpoint, I was, you know, amazed, and I was, you know, super proud of how everybody came together, and it almost made me rethink a little bit more the way that I run events. And I know that not everybody has the capability to have a staff that's as deep and as wide and as talented as the national staff has, but I think there definitely is some learning to be done, and I think something to be gained and something to be taken away from here with having a, you know, like a second in charge, a number two. And I know a lot of race directors out there, and I'm sure you guys know the same, who are kind of, you know, they come in, they run the show, they don't want anybody to mess with what they do, and they don't really feel comfortable in sharing what they're doing. And, you know, God forbid that something would happen to them on race day or during the race. You know, somebody's got to pick up the pieces and be able to, you know, take the ball and run with it. And I would hope that this becomes a more of a maybe a progressive model that we end up pushing out or we end up encouraging from a national standpoint. But do you guys see it as something that we could kind of put together at some point in time and say, you know, this is probably the ideal model for race production, you know, kind of going forward?
Yeah, I think there's almost kind of like a best practices, you know, that we could kind of provide and not to get too off topic, but for race identification, for example, Matt worked really hard on a best practices document. So tattoos, you know, recommended size, average size, minimum size, things like that. So I think it's something from our end that, yes, I do. Certainly making sure those resources are there, but really, you know, when that happened in Florida for the kind of example that we're talking about, making sure that the entire staff knew that, you know, Matt stepping in to be in charge had the latitude to make those decisions, and, you know, Matt should be treated as they would have treated me as director of the race. So I think it's kind of the whole empowerment piece that you give to not only kind of your number two in charge, but the rest of the staff, where, like Chris, with you guys out on the bike course, for example, you know, giving you guys, making sure you're properly educated and properly armed. What we see sometimes from our end, even at the national office, is that you may bring in somebody to work the bike course, for example, but they don't know the traffic control plan. They don't know the course like they should know the course. They don't know if it's a full or partial closure. They don't know what time the roads close at. So it's really important that all of your staff, from the top all the way down to whatever coordinator you have at whatever level, is totally in tune with the event. So that way, when they're out there, you know, if you feel comfortable with giving them the latitude to make those decisions, or at least the comfort for them to ask a question to you without them feeling like, oh, I don't know kind of what I'm talking about and I shouldn't have to be asking that question. So in short, yes, I think that's really important. And I think it's also very important, you know, we had spoken about, you know, Matt being able to step in and equally as educated were Kelsey and Cody, for example, from our team, kind of within the national events team, but also making sure that really all of your staff is well versed with the event as a whole. So even though Chris, you were may have been on the bike course, for example, that you're still in tune with where the run course is going, where the aid stations are. So if somebody does go down on the run course, staff wise, you know, if shifts have to be made, you're still educated enough to kind of make those shifts and make it happen.
Mm-hmm. And kind of going off that too, to echo what Brian said, I think it's a testament to the team, like I said before, but also his direction and the level of preparedness overall. The pre-planning meetings and the emails and, you know, the specific course coordinator calls where, you know, when that situation happened and, you know, the change was being made and I was talking, you know, with personnel on site and the ITU and other things like that and kind of how it was all going to work, there was, I don't think that off the top of my head, there were any times where, you know, I talked with you, Chris, or I talked with Kelsey and Cody on the run course, or Gavin and Scott on setting up the aid stations, where those personnel did not know what they were doing. They knew every time exactly what they were doing, where the cone placements went, where the turnarounds were. So there is a huge testament to Brian's direction and the level of preparedness going into it, you know, that was there. So that was really cool.
Yeah. And you know, it kind of transitioning here a little bit, a lot of the things that you're talking about here in the preparedness, these are elements that are kind of, I would say, taught or given in part of the sanctioning process. And I know I've gone through the race director sanctioning process, and I know that in past, some people have pushed back on it who have been historical race directors for a number of years and like, well, why do I need to go into a certification? And they may feel like they kind of know everything there is to know about their race or anything else, but obviously things change, the market changes, the, you know, athletes are looking for something a little bit different, and it forces race directors to move some things around. These are all pieces that we're incorporating into kind of making each event as safe as they possibly can. Do you see that this is now being kind of like the norm and that sanctioning almost is the expected piece from athletes that are coming to our sport?
Yeah, I think there's two sides of it. So there's the athlete side, and then there's the race director side. So I'll put it back on you, Chris, from the world headquarters. Do you want me to touch on the athlete side or the race director side first?
Let's start with the race director side.
Perfect. So the biggest thing, so we're revamping our sanction system right now. So there's a lot of cool stuff that we're doing with it, not to mention increasing the speed, which will make the process not only quicker from the user, the race director side, but also from our side in making sure that all the minimal qualifications to have the sanction application approved are being met. So there's big things from a race director side, aside from the event insurance that's provided in 99 times out of 100, a lower rate than you would get at doing it as a one-off. So the biggest thing is the comprehensive insurance program that we have. So you may think this just protects, you as a race director, but it actually covers you as a race director, your athlete, volunteer, staff, and sponsors that are involved with the program. So it becomes a good tool for you to have should something arise. Also, it covers your general liability and then the athlete excess medical coverage. So in the event an athlete would get hurt in the race, let's say they don't have primary insurance, for example, USAT's athlete excess medical coverage will then kick in as that athlete's primary insurance. And they do have primary insurance, it acts as their secondary insurance. If you do sanction, it gives you the opportunity to host our national championship events and special qualifying events. St. Paul, Minnesota, at the world headquarters is, three years now for Winter Tri-Nationals, is that right?
That's right.
So events such as that, everything from Winter Tri to Classe Delfina to off-road to ultra to our multi-sport festival. So it gets you access to do that. Not only does that get you into our national championship calendar, we provide support from our national office. And kind of our hope with that is that once you host what we call one of our non-owned national championships, that you continue the event afterwards, and athletes that may not have been to your race or to your city before continue to go back if you decide to continue that. So there's that aspect. There's opportunity to utilize our USAT certified officials. So we're really trying to bolster that program from our end. So that way, not only do race directors want to have officials at their races and they're not self-officiated, but also that there's availability of officials. So the travel for the officials is a less amount of distance. It provides a higher standard of racing, not only for the race director, but also the athletes. And lastly, I know I'm rambling, but I want to make sure I cover everything. it allows access to the USAT events calendar, advertising opportunity. If your race meets certain thresholds, you can utilize our partners, whether it be Gatorade or something to that effect. So there's a lot of benefits for race director to sanction. You also get the really cool logo that you put on your site that says it's the USAT sanctioned race. And a lot of athletes will only do USAT races for the sake of national ranking. So that's kind of something to keep in mind as well. If an athlete is, whether they're an All-American or they're at the bottom of rankings, that standard is going to be met from a safety standpoint, from a, lifeguard to swimmer ratio standpoint. And they know it's going to be a safe race. So that's one of the biggest things in benefits of sanctioning as a race director.
Yeah, and I think that it is a big piece, and the Winter Tri has been a lot of fun. Cody's come out and partied it up, but it is fun being a part of that, and there are it's a great opportunity to be a part of the national championship family, and we have also had duathlon nationals out here in St. Paul that we had had that for 2 years. That was also good times. Mm-hmm. As you guys saw, it just seems like that the sanctioning is there's so much more to it that it does now seem to be a changing market for races. It seems to be a changing market for athletes and what they're looking for. I know that here in Minnesota recently, four races that were historically larger races are not going to be put on this year. And that's, and that's due to, shrinking sizes that they've incurred. But the one common denominator I have seen with them is that they are all non-sanctioned races. And I wonder if, if the race is just being put on for profit, or if, what is the driver there for producing the race. But also, I fear that sometimes when races get put in these positions, that one of the things they may skimp on is safety. And I've seen that happen where it's like, oh well, we don't need to have so many volunteers out there, or maybe we can only have so many police officers, or we don't need to have an ambulance on site, blah blah blah. And the thing that I have enjoyed, especially that I try and preach with sanctioning, is that you get somebody else to be able to look over your plan, and you submit it, and somebody sees it, and you do get another set of eyes. And if you've missed something, I think somebody will help you kind of point that out. And there's a number of opportunities to be able to have the partnering brands and such as with that. But it is, I think it kind of all lands back on safety. And I'm not sure enough race directors these days make that their primary objective.
Yeah, and that's something too, you know, I mentioned the National Events Department and Event Services Department. So for those that don't know, the Event Services Department really takes the lead on reviewing those sanction applications. So with the recent merger of the two departments, now the Events Department, what we want to do in the National Events Department, they're very well-versed, don't get me wrong, in that department, but with us and what was the National Events Department, you know, working through permitting, working through police postings, you know, meter crossings, that we have them, we want to make sure that we are more readily available. So we made it basically a mutual agreement amongst us 9 to 10 people in now this mega department that, you know, if race directors do have questions, we are more than happy to weigh in on those questions and just kind of, I don't want to say best practices, but, you know, kind of give our feedback on a certain intersection, or if they have, you know, these are my two options, what would you choose? And we go back and say, okay, these are the pros and cons, and these are why they're the pros and cons. In large part, that's going to be because of safety. It's not going to be because kind of a one-off, because there's, you know, two more palm trees taking this route versus, you know, you're seeing three more trash cans on this route. So it's really, you know, Chris, like you said, safety is of the utmost importance, and that's something that we're trying to kind of push down from our end at the national office all the way down to even the local race director that may be doing a splash and dash series for kids, that, you know, those standards are met, because at the end of the day, like, you know, it takes one bad experience from one athlete, and the word travels like crazy. You know, there was an officer at this intersection, there was supposed to be, there was a close call or what have you. So I think that's the biggest thing. And the community is so tightly knit that they know the good races, they know the new races. And a lot of people do want to try out those new races, and that's what we want them to do. But just making sure those standards are kind of up to snuff.
And in addition to that, too, kind of as a part of the new, you know, events dynamic, I would say, as you referenced earlier, as Brian referenced earlier, I should say, you know, as part of being a sanctioned race, you do get that race director newsletter, and I have access to the race director toolbox with various resources across the board on how best to put on your event. And as part of that merger, given our event experience putting on national championships, we're looking to upgrade that content within that race director newsletter and then on the race director toolbox as well. So maybe it's, you know, increased best practices, as Brian mentioned, or doing some case studies, you know, like the one we just talked about in Sarasota on contingency planning and things like that. It really just offers kind of more educational content across the board.
Yeah, I think it helps the individual who may feel like they're just alone in the pond as well. They've got, you know, somebody they can reach out to, which is, you know, sometimes a huge benefit and not always as easily achieved as some might see. I know that for me, it seems easy to be able to reach out to a number of different race directors, but I know that that's not the norm, and that's not the case. So I've been a big advocate for sanctioning. I think it kind of standardizes the sport, and I hope other people begin to see that a little bit more. It's hopefully that metric changes a little bit more for us.
Yeah, and too, what we don't want to happen is, you know, whether it's event insurance or, you know, covering yourself from a race director, staff, volunteer standpoint, it only takes one time for something to happen. And if you're not, you know, properly insured, you know, comparing that to what USAP insurance kind of sets forth for you, it just takes that one time, and that is very detrimental to your business. So, you know, looking, you know, if you're a certified race director, you sanction an alt event for $175, that gets you insurance. You can do additional COI, so certificates of insurance, that range in price. You know, the maximum price for those is $10, for a class two. So, it's really, there's the money up front, but if there's something that comes on the back end, you're going to be very thankful that you have that insurance and have USAP, you know, great providers to kind of work you through that process should something happen.
Yeah, but I don't want us to be seen as just an insurance company. I think there are a number of different pieces that that do come up with the benefits of sanctioning. And I think having, you know, the staff being willing to kind of step up and give some one-off feedback and be a little bit more participatory with that, I think that is that's a huge step, and a big kudos for you guys. I know that's you're taking on a lot in doing that, and I think it's a big piece, and it shows your commitment to the safety of the sport, the growth of the sport, and I think the validity of sanctioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, guys, I can't thank you enough for all the time that you have spent here. I know that you guys have two regular jobs that you need to go back to and attend, and you have taken a little bit of your time away to share some things with us. So on that note, I want to thank our hosts, or our friends Brian D'Amico and Matt Rieger for being up here and being on the podcast today.
Thank you very much. It was our pleasure. And I will 100% take you up on the offer for some mountain biking when I get back there.
All right. And I'm going to keep following Brian on Twitter, because he's got, if you guys don't follow Brian D'Amico on Twitter, you should do that, because he puts out almost a daily affirmation. And I'll tell you, it makes me just kind of feel good about myself every day I read those. So
I'm not gonna lie, I'm a good follow. I've just tried to step up my game here recently. So
you have it's legit game, and if you have not followed, what is your Twitter handle, Brian? Is it just your name?
That's a really good question. Let me go. Brian D'Amico one, because Brian D'Amico minus the one was not available.
Wow, there's
and
another
picture, Chris, that you were speaking of as my profile picture on there. So.
Oh, all right.
Make sure you follow the real Brian D'Amico. The real, yes.
Yeah, not the fake, not the fake troll site of Brian D'Amico.
There's a lot of those out there.
Exactly. So. You won't regret it. So. Boys, thank you so much for being a part of our broadcast today. And for everybody, we thank you for spending some time with us, and we look forward to seeing you back in our next one. Ciao.
Stranger, how you and I were strangers. We met and in that moment, it's like something took control. Yeah. And when you told me to come along, it couldn't be wrong. Now I'm getting anything that I need. And some might say we're moving too fast. But you bring out the best in me. Let's keep on saying, cause they don't really know about this thing we all got.